right, DG, welcome. Well, it's a pleasure to have you around. As can be seen in the program, our work today is well cut for us. Only transport were interacting with for today. Let's start with the formalities. DG, may we start with you and your team introducing yourselves, National Treasury, and the AG's office, and then members of parliament, and then we could then get into the business of the morning.
Honourable Chairperson, thank you very much, and thank you very much to SCOPA for the opportunity for us to come and discuss these two important issues, Vote 33 and INEX. My name is Mpumi Mbofu. I'm the Director General of the Department of Transport. I'm here with the Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Dan Pretorius, who is to my left. We have recently also appointed a new DDG Financial Services, Mr. Ritualo, who is the project manager for Unitas, and Mr. Rakhwadi is the CEO of RTMC. The balance of the team are support staff from parliamentary office and chair. We must say we do have a press conference that is scheduled for later on today. So some of the people who are here assisting us with that. That's the Department of Transport team. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Although I don't see Lungisile here, but it's fine. No, it's fine. It's okay. You pushed him from us. He was here. Okay, no, it's fine. National Treasurer.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Marissa Moore from National Treasury, standing in for Mr. Mahesh Fakir.
Okay, thank you. Auditor General.
Good morning, Chair. Lily Zonda, Auditor General.
Chair Pramesh Bana, Auditor General. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair. Edith Belcher, Business Executive Information System Audit, Family Auditor General.
Thank you. May we have members of Parliament introducing themselves, starting with the Honourable Advocate.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies for being late. It's Martin Stevens, Member of SCOPA.
Thank you, Chair. Same here. I'm George Matigiza, SCOPA.
I'm off again, SCOPA.
Trevor Bonham.
Good morning, Comrade Chairperson. Namvula Shangwana.
I'm Pierre John Herber, SCOPA.
Good morning, Greg Schneeman, Joint Budget Committee.
Thank you very much, Comrade Tembagudi. I chair this committee. We once again want to welcome you, DG, and your team to this interaction. I think you'd be the one to bear testimony going to our previous interactions that ours is purely a straightforward interaction on those matters or issues that we believe require clarity for a proper conclusion of our work and responsibility to Parliament in terms of the oversight responsibility that we have. We will start by having a look at the annual report of the department before we appraise us on initiative.
and to start off the process or the program, I will hand over to Honorable Matikiza, Dr. Matikiza, to kickstart the process. Dr. Matikiza.
Thank you, Chair.
May I, before you start, welcome the Deputy Auditor General, Sabwamgera Tatu. Of course.
Thank you, Chair. Madam Accounting Officer, you were here last year on a qualified report. This year you also appear before this committee, though not on a qualified report, and not by default, but by grave emphasis of matter and other reporting issues. What makes these seemingly pertinent issues grave is due to two or three reasons. And the first reason being that these issues have been raised for several times for consecutive financial years with the department, and the department seems to be unable to remedy this. Secondly, is that you at the last engagement gave this committee a dawn of hope with your turnaround strategy, and you resolved not to appear before this committee. But alas me, here you are. And then thirdly, I'd like to mention that the seemingly pertinent issues are the impediments to service delivery. Now, if I can then zoom in on my questions. As at last meeting, that is at last engagement, the committee sent a set of resolutions through Parliament to your department. Now, my question would be, what percentage of the resolutions that were sent to your department that have been resolved? And what number of the recommendations that we sent through to your department were fulfilled?
Honourable Chairperson, thank you very much. In response to the Honourable Member's question, I may start by prefacing my response by saying, as the Honourable Member clearly indicates, at the point of my appearance in the scope of the last meeting, we had a qualified report. I did, Honourable Member, commit to ensuring that the Department of Transport does not have a qualified report. I can confirm I achieved that. The matters of emphasis that do remain partially are a reflection of the complexity of the challenges that we face, but I can confirm also that with respect to all the matters that were raised by SCOPA, we submitted a report to SCOPA to indicate our action plan and our implementation of SCOPA's resolutions. And in that, we can confirm that most of the matters have been resolved. We can indicate upon reflection that there are a couple of matters that could be perceived as not fully resolved on that action plan, one of which is the filling of vacancies, which I'll be able to elaborate upon fully in my response and indicate the nature of the challenge and exactly what has happened with respect to with the filling of vacancies. Honourable Chairperson, in just articulating that particular response, if I may start by saying
I thought you were done.
I don't need to elaborate on the outstanding matters, Chairperson, what are perceived to be outstanding matters. If SCOPA so pleases, I would not. But I'd like to give rather comprehensive understanding of at least their response on the vacancy issue, which seems to...
The vacancy issue, well, yes. in a pointed manner, sure.
In a very pointed manner.
Yeah.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The reality...
Just a minute, yes, Honorable Chair. Okay. No. You're the one that can talk. So that. Okay. Just move your chair next to Honorable Stevens.
Okay. Chair, perhaps while I intervened with her elaborating on this particular issue, perhaps it's going to come up. In my next set of questions. Rather, let's wait for that occasion. Thank you. Now, Madam DG, in terms of the government notice number R81, which repealed the law governing the levies payable by municipal testing centers to the department, levies received after 23rd July 2004, from municipalities should have been refunded, and municipalities notified that this legislation has been repealed. Why has this not happened, and what are you doing to rectify this?
Honorable Chairperson, through you, I can confirm to the Honorable Member that we have refunded all the levies that were outstanding with respect to this matter that relates to the legislation. I can also confirm that the department has further established a further intervention with respect to the responsibilities of the DLTCs and particularly provincial administration, and with respect to that, can confirm that before Parliament as we speak is a piece of legislation which is a further amendment to the Road Traffic Act, which will enable us to strengthen the responsibility of the inspectorates, and more importantly, ensure that the inspectorate is able to take action in the instances of non-compliance by DLTCs and provincial administration.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, DG. Now, was this up after the audit process, this rectification of issues?
Honorable Member, yes, that is correct.
Thank you. The AG has observed during the audit process that levies during 2006-2007 financial year were not even recorded in the levies register. Then why was that?
Honorable Chairperson, we did not receive any levies in the particular period because we had refunded in the previous period all the outstanding levies.
I'm at a loss here because you just confirmed to me that the refunds have been rectified after the audit process. The same audit process says to us the levies are not recorded in the levies register. That it means that during the audit process you had not effected the refunds and they couldn't find any records of the levies that we had received 2006-2007 financial years going back. That's my understanding.
Honorable Chairperson, the auditors could not confirm the completeness of the register of levies. It's not that there were no levies at all that were recorded. They could not confirm the completeness of that record. And that was the issue that was contentious.
Okay, I accept that. And why was that?
The question, why was it that they could not confirm the completeness?
Exactly.
Honorable Stevens, assisting keep in making sure that mic is on when he speaks.
The real reason was because some of the information was not supplied by the DLTCs, and therefore they could not confirm what was available. And hence the measures that we have taken in terms of strengthening the relationship we have with DLTCs and the accountability of those DLTCs. So there were incomplete records because they were not substantiated and submitted by the DLTCs.
Okay, thank you. Let's step off that particular platform. Now, why is it that some debtors, which you classified as fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and yet you disclose them as staff debtors, is there no distinction between the two? That's a fruitless and wasteful expenditure and staff debtors. Is there no distinction between those two items?
Whether shouldn't we allow the gentleman to respond, because I think we're wasting time in them engaging each other now. They should have done it before they came here.
Thank you. With your permission, Chair, I'll allow the CFO to respond.
Thank you, Chair. This particular instance, the auditors found in 2004-05, a tender that, according to the audit finding, was duplicated to an amount of 1.7 million. We subsequently transferred that amount to debts with a view to recover the fruitless and wasteful expenditure. In 2006-07, the auditors insisted on us reversing the amount back to fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which we have done. In the meantime, the duplicated tenders were investigated by experts in the field, and the eventual finding of the experts, the conclusion is that the tenders were not duplicated. There could have been one portion. Some subjects were developed for road traffic management training, and those subjects in the second tender had to be aligned to the new SACWA requirements. But they were not agreed done. All of those documents, the report was handed to the auditors to now decide whether, in fact, those contracts were duplicated. The expert opinion is that the contracts were not duplicated. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, CFO. Accepted. With regard to the long overdue debtors, the AG has observed that there is no evidence of proper follow-up by either the legal or finance departments. why have you not done anything about this?
Honorable member, we have actually followed up and concluded these matters, and both our legal and financial sections have done so.
Thank you. The fact that the department was unable to differentiate between the classification of actual revenue received prior to 23rd July 2004 and payable received after 23 July 2004 was due to inadequate record keeping and control over the completeness of receipts. Why was this the position?
Chairperson, through you, as we indicated during the said period that the member refers to, which is up to 2004, there were serious challenges at DLTCs in terms of collecting information and keeping accurate records on the register, and that was the challenge that the department faced up until the point of intervention. Now, the part of the real challenge was in the legislative framework, the issues relating to concurrence and responsibilities, and particularly the introduction of powers that are vested in provincial MECs, which to a large extent meant the functions and administration of DLTCs and their accountability lie with MECs rather than with the national department, and as the law stipulated at the time. And that created a particular constraint in terms of the national department's ability to make particular demands if that compliance was not enforced by the provincial administration and the MECs vested with that function. As I indicated, we have a legislative amendment that is attempting to deal with that to increase our level of accountability, but also our ability to penalize DLTCs that are non-compliant, which includes closing them down and penalizing them in various other ways if they don't comply with the information requirements.
Thank you. It was observed that there was no evidence that a monthly report to National Treasurer was submitted by no later than 20 days of each month after transferring funds by the National Transferring Officers, as is prescribed by the Division of Revenue Act, Section 25.5. Your comment on that?
Thank you, Chairperson, and through you to the member. This particular issue relates to PTIF, a fund established for the sole purpose of financing public transport infrastructure systems and infrastructure, established in 2005. The first allocation of which was in the region of 200 million, which has subsequently in total been increased to 13.6 billion. The first couple of years of the implementation of that program, in fact, if I may say, the first allocation was made mid-year through the financial year. It was one of those anomalous allocations that was made through the adjustment of 2005. The result principally was that the first couple of years of the implementation of that program, including the 2005, 2006, 2006, 2007, of which there was a total of about 700 million.
Just focus on the question itself.
Okay.
There was non-compliance in terms of reporting. Why was that? What has been done to sort that one out?
Thank you, Chairperson. I was just giving the history so we understood what the project was about.
Yeah,
but simply...
No. We're dealing with a lot of DORA matters in other departments, so we know there is that challenge of reporting.
On this specific issue, Chairperson, it related particularly to the capacity of the municipalities to supply adequate reports at the time that they were required, which was the 20th of each month, with respect to the DORA requirements. And that specifically was because in the first couple of years, which is where I would have led to, of the implementation of the program, there was not much delivery in terms of the implementation of the programs, primarily in 2005, there was a late allocation. So as we were requiring reports, municipalities had nothing to report in 05-06 because they had only received the money around October. In 06-07, they had started implementation of the particular project, and then we were starting to get reports. We did get reports in 06-07, but we did not get them in all instances. There are a couple of municipalities where capacity remained a challenge, and the starting of the project was actually delayed because of long-term planning. I refer specifically to the whole cities of Rustenburg.
Let's do this. I think the issue at point here is that you were not getting reports in time as per the agreements that you have signed with the municipalities.
Correct.
And I think what we would want to get is, between then and now, what is it that has happened to change that situation? Because the reporting time frames are part of the agreement and the basis on which money was released. But the observation of the AG is that whilst you have given money, the municipalities are not meeting their side of the bargain. So what we have to check is, where are we now? Fine, they are reporting, but are they reporting in time? And are we getting, at a qualitative level, information that that is useful, that lives up to the expectation of the Act?
Honourable Chairperson, I can confirm that to date we are receiving full reports from municipalities on time on all projects. But more importantly, when we saw this problem around 2006, we made an intervention. We established a special task team that is employed by the National Department, which goes out there, collects information, and then reports are submitted on time by the 20th by Treasury in all cases, as we speak.
So in this coming audit, we will not have that as a challenge?
Definitely not, Chair, not on PTIS, no.
Right. I hope you can share your success formula with your colleagues in other departments. It appears they're actually saying it's impossible to correct the situation. But I'm just hoping that maybe you could share how you managed to get that right.
It's called the pressure of 2010, Chairperson, because this is what this money is for, and it requires very stringent arrangements around that. But surely it's a good model to be shared across other programs, but what has made it necessary is just that.
Thank you,
Chair. Thank you, DG, for that comprehensive response. Section 21 of DORA prescribes coordination and cooperation between the internal audit units of the transferring national department and the internal audit units of the recipient provincial departments and municipalities. Further, the transferring national department, the recipient provincial departments and municipalities must regularly report to their own audit committees on compliance with this section. There is no evidence to this effect from the AG's observation. Your comment.
Honorable Chairperson, through you, initially there was, and this matter refers to the particularly the Gautrain allocation. Initially, it is correct that there was inadequate arrangements in terms of the coordination between the internal audit unit of the Department of Transport as transferring department and that of the province. But Chair, now our response would indicate this is a particular challenge that required us to seek assistance from National Treasury in order to resolve it. And in our seeking that assistance, we have enabled the National Treasury to establish a coordinating mechanism between our internal audit units as transferring departments and the recipient departments and provinces, and that forum is coordinated and chaired by National Treasury and facilitates that particular interaction between
What was the point of challenge? I mean, if, say, the provisions of DORA are that there should be liaison or proper interaction, then for me, it sounds very simple and straightforward. What was the area of challenge?
time I say it is not the norm that there are interactions that are held between a transferring department and a recipient department on the operational issues. But it has not been the norm for the internal audit components of both the transferring and recipient department to be collaborating. I think matters would be raised in the norm of collaborating, but it looked to us that we needed a specific relationship, a much more direct relationship between the two internal audit functions, and for that reason, we needed that to be coordinated at a different level via National Treasury than for us. Our meetings continue for operational matters, but facilitating the internal audit arrangements required that to be done at a much bigger scale than just one-on-one between ourselves and the recipient authority.
So there was no challenge in the context of resistance from either side in terms of cooperation?
Not necessarily, Chair, but it was something that, what I'm suggesting is that it's an unprecedented arrangement, so we had to enforce it and make sure that it actually exists and enforces.
All right.
Thank you. Another observation is that in many instances, supply chain management for procurement were not followed in all respects. For example, quotations were not obtained, and in some instances, completion of order and requisitions were only done after the service has been provided. Now, what has the department done to the officials responsible for this, starting from the junior officials to their supervisors, because it's an ordinary standing arrangement that there be quotations at least three, and so forth?
Through you, Honorable Chairperson, we did face particular challenges in this area, and very specifically in the cases that did occur in the department, we took appropriate measures, disciplinary measures, and took action against the said official. In one instance, which relates to the biggest amount that is affected by this, which involved a chief director, we proceeded with disciplinary measures against the chief director, which resulted in their dismissal. In another instance, which relates to meals, evening meals, where emergency circumstances prevail and people are not able to get, or in this particular instance, did not get three quotations as is required, we were quite able to establish and enforce through supply chain the mechanisms to allowing for the database of people from which they would order getting the three quotations and enabling that to happen. So that matter has been substantially resolved. It's no longer a matter that would ever occur. Partly, I think it was the emergency circumstances under which those particular instances happened that prevented that.
Thank you. With regards to business travel by employees, your department could not provide the auditors with the VA-26 forms for traveling so undertaken. Now, can you comment on this? Why is this the case? And what has the department done to those employees who so undertook such traveling without proper traveling authorization documentation? And also, what have you done about the travel agency so involved in this query?
Honorable Chairperson, through you, the matter of VA-26 forms really only relates to travel under emergency circumstances. It does not pertain to all travel. It is a specific issue relating to emergency travel where an official outside of office hours is required to travel to a particular destination. Normally it's Cape Town. Most of them are domestic travel. And in that after-hour period, the official is not able to obtain proper authorization for travel because the instruction to travel is only issued after 4 o'clock. What we have now in order to resolve this problem is a special arrangement that has been put in place, which is a special dispensation for after-hours travel.
Let me get this straight. So okay. In such emergency cases, after the travel has been affected, the said officials will then fill the requisite forms I think what the Auditor General is saying is that not in all instances were such forms submitted, whereas travel had been effected. And the question was, why were the forms not there? And what is it that has been done to ensure that this does not recur?
Chairperson, what we then did when the problem was identified was to institute an arrangement which, in two cases specifically, penalizes or allows, firstly, in process terms, for an email to be sent in the morning after the travel to the said official to fill in that form and almost force them to. Because I think the weakness of the previous arrangement was that we left it to the official to do it. Now they get a reminder.
Actually, there was no proper supervision. That is, the managers were not properly monitoring and supervising and ensuring that these processes are followed to the letter. That's the long and the short of it.
The long and the short of it is it was left up to the official and the supervisor did not to follow up. But now we have a travel agent sending, or the officer responsible sending an email to the official in the morning and requiring them to actually fill in that. And now we also have other measures, which mean if that reconciliation is not done on the previous travel, we do monthly assessments with the travel agent, but also importantly, if the fault, which is sometimes the case, falls with the travel agent rather than with the official, it is to the travel agent's account rather than to the department's account. We also have stringent measures for where you have instances of non-compliance by officials. We have salary deductibility for unreconciled expenses that have been occurred on travel. So that system is working for us now, and it's not a matter that is one left.
Okay.
Thank you. The AG has also observed that the department has no policy regulating the late clearance of travel and subsistence advances. And then what would be the explanation for this simple and obvious omission? And what is the position now?
Honorable Chairperson, the challenge emerges out of, in this particular case, not emergency travel, but international travel. And we have resolved that problem through what I also indicated we apply on the emergency travel situation by penalizing officials and not allowing them to take a second trip. There are a number of requirements we've also included in the travel submissions, which are, one, a report of the previous travel, two, a confirmation from finance that that particular reconciliation of the claims relating to the previous trip has been done, but more importantly, if a particular period prescribes before that official is able to sort out their reconciliation, that money is taken off their salary. That is now in our current travel policy. It is understood, it is practiced, and quite happily there is, I would say, 100% compliance as a result of it.
So we will not have cases of irregular expenditure?
With respect to international travel, Chairperson, not.
But in relation to other matters that cannot be ruled out?
Chairperson, we make best effort to ensure 100% compliance on all matters. But in the nature of the business that we run, I cannot say to you we would have 100%. We'll aim for 99%.
But I'm tempted to say so. Because your responses on the matters identified by the AG seem to project a watertight responses or solutions. And it will be unfortunate if you only respond to issues identified by the AG and yet in the course of your normal work, certain areas do not get focused because they are not mentioned in the AG's report. That's why I was saying, so it might as well be that we will not have instances of irregular expenditure because of the kind of controls that you seem to be put in place. You know, that's what comes through to me.
Chairperson, I would indicate that we have made best attempt to change the culture and the stringent measures we have put in place which penalize bad behavior, we hope is going to ensure that we don't have any irregular expenditure across the board.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
During the salary audit of employees' cost, it was identified that two salary reports were not approved by the responsible line managers. One of the unsigned salary reports contained an update note by one of the line managers stating that two employees listed on that report were not part of his department. Now, what disciplinary measures have been taken against the responsible officers, and what measures have been taken to ensure that this was not a fraud attempt by junior officials? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not aware of the instance where employees were on the salary report that were not employed by the department. There were instances where employees were listed on the salary report as not belonging to that particular responsibility.
I think that's what it's saying. I think that is...
Yeah. We implemented a system. We had a problem in the previous year of salary reports not being signed off on a monthly basis, or they were signed off but very late, because it's a control measure whereby the relevant manager signs off to verify that those employees on that particular payroll under that responsibility are employed and they are paid properly. It's a control measure to ensure that there are no ghost employees. What the responsibility managers then do, if an employee appears on the payroll but does not belong under that responsibility, the responsibility manager would make a note to indicate to finance and human resources that this employee does not belong on that particular payroll. We would then follow up to find out, together with our human resources unit, where that employee belongs in the first place, and then ensure that the employee would be shifted to be reflected on the correct responsibility. For those that were queried by the responsibility managers, they were corrected. There were no ghost employees. Their allocations, their cost allocations, went to the wrong responsibility and objective.
Okay.
What we did subsequently is we implemented a system to ensure that the payrolls are signed off regularly. Where they are not signed off, we tabled that at our executive committee
at what regular interval?
Monthly.
Okay. All right. No, fine.
And I can confirm that the payrolls for the financial year that has passed have all been signed off properly.
Okay. Thank you. I'm
partly covered, Chair. I'm partly covered. Is this sign off before the actual salary payout or after the salary payout? Thank you.
Chair, thank you. This is after the salary payout. Our budget controllers in every unit goes and collects, and only dedicated people can collect pay slips and payrolls once the pay run has taken place and the printouts have been made. Then the people are supposed to sign to indicate that that the pay roll that has just taken place is correct, and it should be signed every month as per Treasury regulations.
But how would it happen that people would appear in sections to which they do not belong, and how prevalent is this occurrence, or has this occurrence been?
This happens. I wouldn't say regularly, but it does happen from time to time, where a new appointee starts, and the person is the. It could be due to a number of reasons that the person who captures the new employee on personal captures the objective and responsibility codes incorrectly, but more so it happens where people move within the department from the one area to the other. That happens quite often, and then that internal movement from one area to another is not captured
okay.
until the responsibility manager picks it up.
Okay.
Thank you. How did we ensure that this particular case was not an attempted fraud by some junior officials in collusion with the management? Thank you.
Chief, thank you. This whole system of salary payroll sign-offs is aimed at finding and detecting fraud. In those instances where people were listed as not belonging to a particular payroll, we then take it from the financial management, take that up with human resources, because human resources captures the people in personnel, finance makes the payments, so that there must be collaboration between the two to effect fraud. What we do is we get the original file and we make sure that the people were properly appointed, and we find out to what which area they were appointed.
I think the import of what he's trying to find out is that if a person's name appears in a wrong section, does it still appear in his correct or her correct section? And what is the implication of that in terms of their payment?
Jay, when an employee appears in the wrong section, that correction is made, and the new manager, the manager where the employee should be paid from, must then also sign off to verify that that employee belongs in that area. So it's a sign off where there is an error between our finance section, who takes this up with human resources. Human resources is then requested to correct that allocation, and the new responsibility manager, or the component under which the employee actually vests, must also verify that the employee is appointed in that position.
Okay. All right.
Okay, thank you. Why is it your department did not stick to the payroll certification by the chief financial officer? It has been found that these were signed off en masse. For example, on the 4th October 2006, for the first 5 months, these salary reports, and then the second batch was signed off by the CFO on 16 August 2007 for the last 7 months of the financial year. Well, why is it happening in that way?
Why this is happening is that we have a payroll which is for 1 month. It comprises a full leverage file of every single payroll that was made, signed off by every employee. There's a slip where every employee signs, and that employee's manager signs. Now, a month's payroll cannot be signed off unless all the signatures are on that month's payroll. That is essentially the problem, to get signatures, because people are not always in the office, and it's quite a number of signatures to obtain. And that was essentially the reason for payrolls having been signed off late. Since then, we delegated the responsibility to the various budget controllers in the components to have those payrolls signed off and actually to walk around with those payrolls to get them signed off. Because if it just goes through the normal mail, a payroll may get stuck, or one page of the payroll may get stuck in an office while the person is not in the office.
Okay. Look, I don't say I'll step off that now. Let's talk now to vacancies. With the state of vacancy assembly in your department, and we hear that plus minus 140 are middle and senior management, and these have been vacant for between 8 and 14 months, how do you then expect to render effective and efficient service delivery in that sort of environment? Thank you.
Chairperson, if I may beg your indulgence on this one, we think it requires a comprehensive response.
No, not too much. I think what we need is subsequent to this report.
Yeah.
Has there been any movement in terms of your levels of vacancies? If there has been no movement, why?
Okay.
If there has been any movement, what amount of movement? Okay. Just that.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just very briefly, the challenge that the Department of Transport faces in terms of vacancies is not about non-filling of posts only, but it relates specifically to an expansion strategy of the department. In 2006, the minister approved a new staff establishment for the department, which aimed to introduce 99 new posts. The vacancy rate at that time was around 36%, and the introduction of those new posts increased that vacancy rate substantially. We had that additional 99 posts approved by National Treasury as a plan, but agreed for implementation on a phased basis. Every new financial year, we get new money allocated for us to activate new posts. The result is that in a financial year, from April to April, we have seen a decline in the vacancy rate. At every April, we then have an increase in that vacancy rate simply because we add new posts every financial year. And that is what the challenge has been. So we've vacillated between 35%. At one stage, it went up to 40. Chair, I can indicate that there are several other interventions were made, including retention strategy, offer policy, counter-offer policy, and other measures which have actually stabilized our vacancy rate now at 29%. But we've made an analysis which we're able to show you and demonstrate that if we had not increased the staff establishment in that period with that said number of posts, our vacancy rate would be at 14%. So the vacancy rate is artificially increased by the introduction of a substantial number of posts, which was part of our expansion strategy. And we have the facts and figures to show that, and we can circulate that to members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The AG alleges that part of your challenges with regards to this particular issue is that some professional positions are not appropriately remunerated. Your comment on that?
Yeah, let us say the AG states, because the AG does not allege.
Chairperson, there may be an element of truth in that, but that's not a prevalent issue. There are a number of professional posts, highly qualified professional posts, where we find in the areas of IT, in the technical areas such as aviation, maritime, economic regulation, that we are not able to attract the necessary levels of skills of people into the department because of the salary structure of the public service. In those instances, we have either found ways of creating